The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program, including the monotony of the impeachment trial in the Senate. We've got a montage prepared for you today, so hopefully that'll bring you right up to speed with it. If you haven't been able to watch much of that, which I would imagine most Americans have not, we'll come to that a little bit later in this segment. Also, the President of the United States had some interesting comments yesterday at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. So we'll play a couple of clips from his comments there in Switzerland as well. In this first segment, you're going to notice some pretty sharp contrasts. Of course, we've pointed it out between the Democrats and the Republicans with respect to impeachment or this presidential administration. You obviously have some stark differences between the previous administration, the Obama administration, and now the Trump administration. And my father's pointed out before, clearly a new direction for the United States. But more broadly, you see quite a few stark differences between Gentile powers, Gentile police states, and the governments ruling the Israelite nations. Those governments, of course, are changing all the time. And yet, with some of these authoritarian powers, they're not only expanding their powers, in some cases, they're in for life. And all of these sharp contrasts, they're leading to colossal conflicts, colossal struggles, and clashes between nations, great nations, powerful nations. Last week we talked about Vladimir Putin's power grab, and this really does have some important implications for the whole world, for all of us. Bloomberg had a piece over the weekend, Putin the Tsar is more dangerous than ever to the United States. Putin the Tsar, this is like, it's like we're going back to the 1700s, the 1800s. You've got President Xi in China. He's the premier for life. And here's Putin the Tsar now. That Bloomberg piece, by the way, it's by James Stavridis, I think is how you say his name. He's a retired U.S. Navy admiral. And he says here, Vladimir Putin will be the czar of all the Russians for another decade and more. Only health appears likely to change the course upon which he now sails, much like President Xi Jinping in China. Putin will now be able to shape events and planning indefinitely. Now, I want you to think about some of our literature, the kings of the East. We've got the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet. We're living in the last days. We're seeing major power blocks come together just as is prophesied in your Bible. Bloomberg said, or this Stavridis said in the article, that Putin's going to continue on with his expansionist policies. He's trying to bring more of Russia's neighbors into Russia's orbit. Of course, he wants to divide NATO and pull more and more allies of the United States away from America. And he's having some success in doing just that. Bloomberg says this, of most concern to the West, Putin and Xi can now deepen their already tight relationship with the advantage of a long, long runway. Militarily, China and Russia are cooperating as never before. Did you get that? They're cooperating as never before. Russia and China in prophecy. That cooperation will increase. It will strengthen in the years ahead. The prophesied prince of Russia, that's the one we referred to last week. Now, that's just one article in Bloomberg. There have been quite a few other articles of late talking about this cooperation between these two states, these two regimes. Neil Ferguson here in the UK, he wrote about Russia and China on Sunday at the Sunday Times, and he said, no two world leaders see one another more frequently. Xi has even called Putin his best friend. What happens in a world when China and Russia are best friends? These are leaders that visit one another all the time, strengthening those alliances, the kings of the East. And of course, this comes at a time when they've both now cemented their positions of power. They're there for good. They are there for the long haul. Bloomberg says, when I was, Stavridis, he says, when I was a strategic planner in the Pentagon as a junior rear admiral, we did high fives if we managed to construct strategic plan for just 5 years, which most often they fell apart if the administration changed. For Russia, so you get his point, with America, sometimes the presidents will change every 4 years. Here in Great Britain, we've had a changeover, three or four of them in the last 5 years. It's not going to be like that in Russia. It's not going to be like that in China. Not for some time, anyway. It says, for Russia, there will be a single hand on the tiller. While that will have many disadvantages, it creates a streamlined decision-making process that often allows long-term planning to succeed. So while you have the governments in Israel, what a contrast, right? While you have the governments in Israel, they just come and go, and you couldn't be more different than Barack Obama and Donald Trump. There's some few similarities, of course. Spending, isolationism, that sort of thing. But these are huge differences between the two administrations. Putin is all that Russia has known for 20 years. I forget how long Xi's been in power, but they're there. They're set. They've cemented their positions. And furthermore, they're quite willing to wait patiently to just move forward step by step, even if they're baby steps, to fulfill their ambitions, their goals, their dreams of world dominion. That's what it amounts to. That's what we're seeing. What a difference. Here you've got a president now in the U.S. He's very different than the previous president. But yet look at how he comes under attack. That doesn't happen to Putin. You don't attack Vladimir Putin. If you do attack him in Russia, you end up disappearing. We mentioned last week, the real persecution against the media, against journalists, it's happening in places like Russia and China, not in the United States, because a president gets up and says it's fake news. That's not persecution. That's actually the truth. But the point is, look at these stark differences. Russia, China, they're working away, patiently going on from year to year. But we have to step back and look at the bigger picture. We have to understand the grand sweep of history and prophecy. What was that title at Bloomberg? More dangerous. Putin the Tsar is more dangerous than ever. Than ever. He's setting himself up to rule for life. George Friedman, he had a piece this week with some fascinating thoughts and analysis on Russia's moves of late. Of course, we know about the changes in place now, the parliament being dissolved and Putin saying he's going to change the constitution. We covered that last week with you. But as Friedman brings out, at the same time we see these dramatic changes in Russia's government and its constitution, Russia's also, or Putin anyway, is revising Russia's history. In the past, Putin, when he's talked about Joseph Stalin and the deal that he made with Hitler prior to World War II, he's discussed that as being a mistake. But here recently, again, this is coming from a Friedman column. Here recently, he's put more of the blame on the allies, Britain, the United States, and even Poland. And he's said that, well, Stalin really had no choice. He had to make an agreement with Germany, because look at what Poland was doing. And oh, by the way, look at the West. Look at the UK. Look at how they were trying to appease Germany. We had no choice. Of course, just like all of Putin's lies, there's an element of truth to it. Western weakness certainly did factor into the cause for the Second World War. But here comes Putin. He's now revising the history, saying that Russia dividing Poland and Eastern Europe, coming to an alliance with an evil dictator, he's saying that really that was a good thing. Friedman says this: it's revealing, however, that Putin felt it necessary to reopen the question of who started World War II at this time. Putin is not a casual man, so he didn't do this carelessly. After announcing the shakeup of the Russian regime, he decided to charge Poland, France, and the UK with responsibility for World War II, cleansing Russia of any wrongdoing in allying with Hitler. See, we didn't do anything wrong. This alliance with Hitler that's there in our history, that was actually forced upon us. We had no choice. Who's to blame? Well, it's Poland. It's France. It's the UK. Friedman suggests that you see these two things happening simultaneously. All these massive changes in Russia's government, and then Russia revising its history. Because, as he says, Russia's preparing for war, or I think he maybe says it more in a, they might be preparing for war. That's what we can read into this. He says, in this sense, Putin's restructuring of the Russian government makes sense. It was an unwieldy bureaucracy that would have difficulty aligning its economy with military action. Therefore, it is reasonable to wonder whether Putin attempts to redefine history and the government were designed as preparations for war or for victory by intimidation. I mean, you have to admit that everything is going to be much more streamlined now, and it just gives him more freedom to act. And it's the same over in China. Friedman suggests that that it may be a conflict that's coming with Belarus, one of the Baltic states. And he highlights, I guess I don't need to read all the quotes, but he just highlights how important this little nation is strategically and how it's in the midst of a tug of war between the European powers and, of course, Russia. But Belarus, that pushes Russia right up next to Poland's border. So it really is a significant piece in the puzzle, and as my father's brought out in our literature, the prophesied prince of Rosh, this prince, it's in your Bible, Ezekiel 38, he has an expansionist view. He's rebuilding a kingdom, an empire. And then we've seen it on the march in Georgia and Ukraine already. Friedman says this: so there has been significant tension between Poland and Russia over Belarus. Belarus is important enough to Russia to consider military action, and the two countries have staged huge war games near Poland's border in the past. Poland may see any such move as indicating war, if not now, then later. Last week, as I say, we covered that prophecy in Ezekiel 38, where the correct translation, it should read, the Prince of Rosh of Meshach and Tubal. These are all regions in what is today Russia. My father says, this giant swath of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union. That's the booklet there at thetrumpet.com. This prince of Rosh, whose mindset is toward expansionism, he really does uphold Russia's, as he sees it, its glorious past, the Soviet Empire. And as I say, now he's revising the history leading up to World War II. We talked last week about the 200 million man army, how that you couldn't have that. It would be impossible unless you had many of these states in Asia that have massive populations coming together in an alliance. And of course, that's what your Bible says will happen. The kings of the East, the kings, plural, Russia and China in particular. Herbert Armstrong was writing about this, this Russian-China axis as early as 1934 in The Plain Truth, almost 100 years ago, 85, 86 years ago. He said in The Plain Truth, two great military powers will arise in the last days. One, the revival of the Roman Empire by a federation of 10 nations in the territory of the ancient Roman Empire. The other, it says, Russia with her allies, possibly China or Japan. Now, if you look back even at the recent history of the past 86 years since that was written, toward the end of the Cold War in particular, Russia and China were hardly friends, certainly not best friends. In some ways, they were enemies. And now look at them today. Neil Ferguson wrote on Sunday, these two world leaders meet more than any two in the world. President Xi, President Putin. What a stunning turnaround. I guess if you could even call it that. It's an accurate prediction based on the sure word of Bible prophecy. Armstrong was writing about it in 1934. And of course, we've written all about it in those two booklets I mentioned earlier. Yesterday, President Trump was in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, and he was there talking about the resurgence. Here's a Fox News montage of President Trump talking about the positive signs in the U.S. Regarding its economy. Clip 6.
Since my election, America has gained over 7 million jobs. Just last week alone, the United States concluded two extraordinary trade deals. The agreement with China and the United States Mexico-Canada agreement. As a result of our efforts, investment is pouring into our country. We've regained our stride, rediscovered our spirit, and reawakened the powerful machinery of American enterprise. America is thriving. America is flourishing. And yes, America is winning again like never before.
America is surging, he was saying. It's thriving. It's winning again. It's flourishing. The Telegraph here in the UK talked about this conference at Davos, saying that environmental issues have dominated many of the speeches, particularly with the wildfires in Australia. And the president made these remarks with respect to the climate change activists, the extreme climate change activists. I thought this was interesting. Clip 1.
This is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process, because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action. But to embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse. They are the heirs of yesterday's foolish fortune tellers, and I have them, and you have them, and we all have them. And they want to see us do badly, but we don't let that happen. They predicted an overpopulation crisis in the 1960s, mass starvation in the 70s, and an end of oil in the 1990s. These alarmists always demand the same thing: absolute power to dominate, transform, and control every aspect of our lives.
That's the president pushing back at these climate change extremists and exposing all the instances where they got it flat out wrong. And a lot of the press here in the UK, of course, took it to be a not so thinly veiled swipe at Greta Thunberg, the teenager, who's now become the face of the climate change movement. But I thought what was interesting there is particularly that statement where he says, "We must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse." Now, in what we've written at the Trumpet about climate change, my father had an article in February of 2018, and we've had many others along the way. But, of course, he talked about what the Bible says regarding weather-related disasters and what the real cause is. Now, this is a message that's not going to be well-received within even the traditional Christian world. God says it gets back to our sins. My father then also, and you know this if you've been regular listeners, in that saving America from the radical left temporarily, that was a year and a half ago, he talked about, again, a type of the prophet Amos, this is from Amos 7, of course, coming on the scene and warning the people of Israel, warning the United States of God's impending judgment. And the prophecy says that they will not receive it. So it's not hard to cheer him on when he's pushing back against these radical leftists. But your Bible says he'll also push back at a message that says these things are being caused by our sins. We are to blame. And then you add to that so many of these prophecies that are unfolding right now. I mentioned the kings of the East. Mr. Armstrong talked about the Federation of 10 Nations in Europe. That's coming too. But think about all that happens. Great tribulation, Jesus said in Matthew 24. It gets so bad that were it not for God's intervention, we would completely extinguish ourselves from off the face of this earth. Those are some sobering prophecies. Those are some prophecies of doom, for sure. Of course, we know there's hope in the end. But Amos 7 shows us that there's a Jeroboam leader that's not going to receive that warning, that message of doom as he sees it. In fact, it's a message of hope. Well, as I said at the start, you see a theme of stark contrast in all of these stories that we're focusing in on today. And when you listen to the back and forth in the impeachment trial, certainly that's on full display as well. Here's an impeachment montage that I think fairly well sums up what happened yesterday in the United States and I think late last night as well. Clip two.
This impeachment fails. It fails factually. It fails legally. It fails constitutionally. This is going to be like killing a fly with a sledgehammer. The House Democrats had a weak case, even on a slanted playing field where they made the rules, changed the rules, and broke the rules to their advantage. On a level playing field, it's going to get ugly.
That the president claims monarchical powers. I can do whatever I want under Article 2, says he, and then acts on that. Defies everything. Defies the law to withhold aid from Ukraine. Defies the law in a dozen different directions all the time. And lies about it all the time. They will not permit the American people to hear from the witnesses. And they lie. And lie and lie and lie.
And you don't deserve, and we don't deserve, what just happened. The only one who should be embarrassed, Mr. Nadler, is you.
A great many, perhaps even most Americans, do not believe there will be a fair trial. By letting the House call witnesses, by letting the House obtain documents, by letting the House decide how to present its own case and not deciding it for us. In sum, by agreeing to a fair trial. If the Senate votes to deprive itself of witnesses and documents, the opening statements will be the end of the trial. So to say, let's just have the opening statements and then we'll see, means let's have the trial. And maybe we can just sweep this all under the rug.
It's very difficult to sit there and listen to Mr. Schiff tell the tale that he just told. They're not here to steal one election. They're here to steal two elections.
It's remarkable that after taking the action of the breathtaking gravity of voting to impeach the duly elected president of the United States, and after saying for weeks that they had overwhelming evidence to support their case, the first thing that the House managers have done upon arriving finally in this chamber after waiting for 33 days is to say, well, actually, we need more evidence. We're not ready to present our case. We need to have subpoenas and we need to do more discovery because we don't have the evidence we need to support our case. This is stunning. It's a stunning admission of the inadequate and broken process that the House Democrats ran in this impeachment inquiry that failed to compile a record to support their charges. It's stunning that they don't have the evidence they need to present their case and that they don't really have a case. If a litigant showed up in any court in this country on the day of trial and said to the judge, actually, Your Honor, we're not ready to go. We need more discovery. We need to do some more subpoenas. We need to do some more work. They'd be thrown out of court and the lawyers would probably be sanctioned. This is not the sort of proceeding that this body should condone.
They spent the entire day telling you and the American people that they can't prove their case. I could have told you that in 5 minutes.
That's a montage from some of the events yesterday in the Senate that the speaker right before that last one there, lawyer Patrick Philbin, he represents the president's team. I thought the way that he talked about, well, how does it work in any trial or in any courtroom? What if you show up to court and say, Your Honor, we just don't have enough evidence here. We'd like to have more witnesses introduced. We need more discovery. We need more facts. And that judge would just throw it right out of the court. Well, why are you here? And he said they'd probably be sanctioned. In the real world, they'd probably be sanctioned. They'd be penalized. As it is, they're able to get away with it because they have the support of the media, changing the rules as they go. Andy McCarthy steps back and gives us the bottom line here, as he says, no matter what the president may have wanted the Ukrainians to do, nothing happened. Ukraine got its defense aid, without any compromise to its security. Zelensky got his audience with Trump. And Kiev was not required to conduct or announce any investigations. No crimes. No crimes. And so what they're going after is what the president might have thought in his mind. They're divining a motive, as William Barr once said. McCarthy says, it also is highly significant that President Zelensky, the only witness who can speak to Zelensky's own state of mind. You want to talk about divining a motive? What? They're divining a motive in Zelensky's mind. And to do that, they have to say he's a liar. Listen to how contradictory this reasoning is coming from the radical left. The only witness who can speak to Zelensky's own state of mind says he did not feel pressured or intimidated. National leaders pressure each other for accommodations all the time. That's not extortion. It's what foreign relations are all about. Yet the logic, listen to this, it's from Andy McCarthy. The logic of the Democrats' argument here is that Zelensky is lying. That is both an unseemly position to take regarding the head of a friendly foreign government and wildly inconsistent with Democrats' posturing about how imperative it is for Washington to support Kiev. You've got to support Kiev, which Obama never did do, by the way. But here are Democrats saying, you've got to support him. You can't delay that funding. And oh, by the way, Zelensky's a liar. when Zelensky says Trump never pressured him, he's lying. They don't say it outright, but that's what you have to conclude to believe what they're saying. That's Andy McCarthy at, National Review. Let me just return you to Pat Philbin, one of the attorneys who, in this piece or clip, talks about the Democrats saying that, well, this is unfair, this process. It's not fair. This is clip 4.
We've heard Manager Schiff say several times that we have to have a fair process here. And I was struck by it that at one point he said, if you allow only one side to present evidence, the outcome will be predetermined. The outcome will be predetermined. That's exactly what happened in the House. Let's recall that the process they had in the House was one-sided. They locked the president and his lawyers out. There was no due process for the president. They started with secret hearings in the basement. The president couldn't be present by his counsel. He couldn't present evidence. He couldn't cross-examine witnesses. And then there was a second round in public where, again, they locked the president out.
They're guilty of exactly what they're charging. Finally, they get into a forum where the president's team has a say. They get to present their arguments, and they know they have no case. That's why you heard in the montage there, Ratcliffe saying, this is like killing a fly with a sledgehammer. Now that it's in a fair forum, now that it's not completely lopsided, they're going to be exposed. And they're being exposed. One final clip from Philbin, clip 5.
So when Chairman Schiff says here that if you only allow one side to present evidence, that predetermines the outcome, that's what they did in the House, because they had a predetermined outcome there, because it was all one-sided. And for him to lecture this body now on what a fair process would be takes some gall.
It does take some gall, but these are people that have had no problem with lying to the American people, lying to television cameras, lying to reporters. They, going back to the Obama years, they bragged about it. They bragged about how easy it was to create a false narrative. Victor Davis Hanson at National Review, again, just to focus in on some sharp contrasts. He says the frenetic opposition to Donald Trump by the Washington establishment, the new progressive hard-left Democratic Party, and in particular, the veterans of the Obama administration, has led to the ruination of a number of hallowed protocols and customs. When I read this article this morning, it just made me think of Isaiah 1. Well, also America Under Attack. We referenced that yesterday. But Isaiah 1, where it just talks about the sickness. The sickness. Look at all of these, as he says, these hallowed protocols that have just been turned on their head because of the previous administration. Impeachment, it says, has been redefined as a mere vote of no confidence and will become a rank political ploy for years to come once an opposition party gains the majority in the House. So this just continues. Now, we can be thankful to God that it's not going to go on for much longer. But supposing it went on for another 20, 30, 40, 50 years, this would now be the norm. Just a simple no confidence. Hey, we don't like you, so we'll create the charges out of thin air and impeach you. And then do everything that we can. If it switches over to the Senate and we don't have the numbers there, we'll do everything we can to try to peel away some weak Republicans. We'll do everything that we can to try to intimidate and pressure. We'll do everything we can to turn loose the major media on our opposition. We'll spread lies. We'll set off a propaganda campaign. Everything. Pull out all the stops. Hanson says whistleblowers are now more political operatives who work with the opposition party to disseminate second and third hand rumor. The FISA court has been disgraced. It was revealed to be either incompetent or actively partisan in its failure to question the Steele dossier's legitimacy in ignoring the warnings of Devin Nunes' memo. Well, they ignored Nunes because he's an extremist, the media said. He's a dunce. He's a California farmer. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a partisan. So here's the FISA court, and they just completely reject. They completely reject Devin Nunes' warnings. And then also that Landmark Legal Foundation, we went through that a few weeks back. They submitted a brief to the FISA court, disregarded it, ignored it. And the FISA court didn't come forward and say, well, I guess there are some problems. Not until the Horowitz report. How convenient. And then to try to correct it, who do they choose to come in and to sort of oversee the process? An anti-Trump partisan named David Chris. He's a believer in the Steele dossier, or at least he certainly was. He hates Donald Trump. You think he's really going to get into the FISA and clean house? Don't count on it. It says in Hansen's piece, in addition, the anti-Trump mob has now ended any idea that prior administrations should step aside, mostly stay quiet, and allow successors to fail or succeed on their merits. And then he goes and just gives this brilliant recounting of the last 30, 40 years. As stark, as sharp as the differences were between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, through the Reagan years, he kept mostly to himself. I mean, here and there, a comment, I suppose, but for the most part, he rode off into the sunset, so to speak, and he let Reagan do his job. And then when George H.W. Bush comes into power in the late 1980s, Reagan quietly let his former vice president do his job. And then most amazingly, H.W. Bush was pretty much quiet during the Clinton years. And Clinton, for the most part, he was more critical of George W. Bush toward the end. But for the most part, particularly after 9/11, when the country was more unified, Bill Clinton and even his wife, they were fairly quiet. And then you come to Obama. Now, just to finish the or close the loop there, you have George W. Bush, who said hardly a thing during the Obama years. He had no problem with Obama trashing the Constitution. Well, I shouldn't say he had no problem with it. He just didn't say anything about it. He let Obama do his thing. And now look at what's happened. President Trump gets into power, and you have all of these former Obama people, and you can lump Hillary Clinton in with it. They will not let this president do his job. He says, just this final paragraph, Bush himself was idealistically silent during the Obama years, despite the Obama administration's turns to the hard left on immigration, healthcare, the Iran deal, and foreign policy. It says, and Obama's constant negative references to Bush himself. How many times did Barack Obama blame George W. Bush? And Bush was silent. And the Obama people now, they are certainly anything but silent. Ben Rhodes, John Brennan, James Clapper, they're out there every day saying Trump's treasonous. He's a Russian agent. Think about these charges. I mentioned last week the influence of Antiochus, the attack on the United States, the attack on its fundamental institutions. It continues. It continues. We see it on display daily. Remember what Obama said back in 2008? Clip 3.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America. They lost the election in 2016, and that's what made their heads explode. And so they'd never mind what some of the senators and congresswomen and men have said on the Democratic side. The impeachment proceedings, really, they began the day Donald Trump got elected. But coming back to Antiochus, yesterday I talked about Virginia and the gun laws that the Democrats are trying to legislate there. And that section in America Under Attack, where my father talks about the Second Amendment, and he speaks also of the executive actions that Barack Obama made. He says, I think those 23 executive orders are really about getting around the Constitution and conditioning the minds of the people to accept the president saying, don't worry about the supreme law of the land. Listen to me. Don't you worry about the law. Don't you worry about the Constitution. You listen to me. And as my father says, that's just what Antiochus did anciently. The spirit of Antiochus, it's as strong as it's ever been. We're just seeing someone, though, who's willing to push back. And that's something my father's written a fair bit about as well. You're listening. Excuse me. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
From our reading of our book club biography, Carl Sandburg's History on Abraham Lincoln, I came upon a speech in the writing of Lincoln's from back in 1856. Lincoln was 47 years old at the time. He had been in Congress in Washington for a couple of years, but then he came back after a two-year stint and I think was just working as an attorney for 5-6 years. So he was out of politics, but they had this political convention. The country was deeply divided at that time. This is, as I say, 1856, not that many years in front of the Civil War. And so he gives this speech about slavery, denouncing the institution of slavery, referring back to the Declaration of Independence, saying that all men are created equal. That applies to everyone of every color. And yet, as he explained, because of intimidation, because of violence even, slavery was making a steady advance across America. It was a hot-button issue in Missouri, in Kansas. Lincoln stood up for the Declaration of Independence. He stood up for God. He said, "But as sure as God reigns and school children read, that black foul lie can never be consecrated into God's hallowed truth." You can't justify this. You can't, you certainly can't call upon the Bible to justify it. You can't call upon the Declaration of Independence to justify it. Well, the point I want to make, just to take a little bit of a left turn here, is that this speech that he gave, this speech was so mesmerizing that the journalists that were there to record the thoughts or the statements, the speech, it went on for 90 minutes. A lot of them just put down their pens because it was so captivating. This is the way Lincoln communicated. He's 47 at the time, and he was obviously preparing for greatness. And in this particular case, the speech was sort of a coming out party for him, as people thought, that's the best speech I've ever heard, and this is presidential material right here. Doris Kearns Goodwin, in her book Team of Rivals, she says, before speaking against the Nebraska Act, Lincoln spent many hours in the state library studying present and past congressional debates so that he could reach back into the stream of American history and tell a clear, reasoned, and compelling tale. He would express no opinion on anything, Herndon observed, that was his law partner. He would express no opinion on anything until he knew his subject inside and outside, upside and downside. Before he spoke about it, he had to know about it. He had to know everything about it. If he didn't know about it, he kept silent. To speak on it, to take a position on it, he had to really study and thoroughly. Earlier this week in our Churchill class, we talked about the wilderness years, the 1930s, and how that, as I was telling the students, you think about descending into the wilderness. You don't really think of, you know, a beehive of activity. You think of, you know, just kind of a loner sitting on a stump looking at a pond or something like that, maybe filling up your journal. But the wilderness years, when you think about the 1930s, or consider the output coming out of Chartwell, what Churchill was producing during those years, he was a political outcast. During those years where he was basically at Chartwell most of the time, this was his place of refuge. During those years, he wrote 11 books and more than 400 articles. So the one historian says that his so-called wilderness years were in fact his most fertile years. This was when he was really thinking about and preparing for the great conflict of the 1940s. And in particular with his four-volume biography on Marlborough, his famous ancestor and Britain's most decorated general. He was living that history again, Marlborough's history again, when he finally came to power as prime minister in 1940. It helped to prepare him. A million words he wrote on his famous ancestor from 1933 to 1938. Now, as I said in the trumpet brief that we sent out last night, what if Churchill had spent the 1930s just kind of flipping through the sports pages, reading trashy novels, going to see movies all the time, or watching television, listening to the radio? Or what if he was just kind of a news junkie, like so many of the talking heads on cable TV are? They just go from one daily news cycle to the next. Few of them rarely giving you any context. What if that's the way Churchill approached his years in the wilderness? When nobody liked him, when he was shut out of social circles. If that's the way he would have approached his so-called wilderness years, well, nobody would probably know Churchill today, or if they did know about him, he'd be more of an obscure figure of history. Certainly there wouldn't be, what, well over 1,000 biographies on this man? Churchill prepared for that great clash between world powers of the 1940s. This historian, David Starkey's his name, he said that putting pen to paper on that Marlboro series, that really put him ahead of the pack once Britain entered its darkest hour, because he knew what to do. He knew how to fight back. He knew what he was fighting for. Well, God had a hand in a lot of this too. God prepared him, but Churchill did his part. He prepared all of those articles, all of those books. He signed the deal to write Marlboro in 1929. It was a 10-year project. 10 years. And then everything else he was doing in the 1930s as well. He created this vast spy network, all these people coming to Chartwell. He was better informed than the prime minister, than Baldwin or Chamberlain. Chamberlain replaced Baldwin in 1937. Even Churchill's individual speeches, 6 to 8 hours, I think it was, that he put in on a 40, 45-minute speech. 6 to 8 hours for a 40-minute speech. I wish we had that much time for some of these broadcasts. It seems like it's rushed in so many cases. But he would go over and over and over his script. And in many cases, it was scripted, all of it. He had a quick wit, of course, but so many of his brilliant phrases and comebacks were actually written down in advance. Preparation is the key. In the 1930s, Churchill prepared himself for the darkest hour. And as I was telling the students yesterday, to prepare means that you have it done, or you have it already constructed, or it's made before you go and deliver it. Before you go and actually carry it out. And you see this in every aspect of life. How well you do in a music recital. It's the preparation beforehand that determines how well you do, in most cases. How well you do when you sit for an exam, or when you deliver a speech, or even when you're doing fun excursions, like touring a historical site. What you get out of it, so much of it, depends on what you put in ahead of time. Ronald Shapiro, in a book he wrote years ago, he said that preparation allows you to act instead of react. Churchill was a man of action. Abe Lincoln was a man of action. These are two very different world leaders in many ways, I suppose, but there's a similarity there, a strong one at that. When you look at how these two prepared for the years of conflict, how they prepared for the years of trial and test. Think about Joseph, a biblical example. I think I mentioned this the other day, Genesis 41. All those prosperous years, those 7 years of prosperity, they were going to be followed by 7 years of famine. God gave that insight to Joseph, and Pharaoh, to his credit, he turned over the Egyptian economy and the Egyptian agricultural system to Joseph, and Joseph prepared for the lean years ahead. He prepared for it. He wasn't caught by surprise. The Bible talks about how that it's going to come upon us suddenly. We're hoping to play that video for you tomorrow, the latest TV program that we recorded. Suddenly and at an instant. And most people are going to be caught totally unawares. Totally shocked and surprised. Mr. Armstrong said we'd be dumbfounded and shocked. The world would be when it sees the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And what about those kings of the East that we talked about in the first segment? We have a lot to prepare for. If we have kind of a wilderness years where we're not that known or that visible just yet, well, that's coming. But what are we doing right now to prepare for what's ahead? That's what's so crucial. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Hopefully tomorrow or Friday we can also get back into some of our feedback, our listener feedback. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.